This is a podcast from 3RRR 102.7 FM in Melbourne. Truly independent community radio.
Good morning, science lovers. It is time for Einstein to Go-Go. It's 3RRR. We're 1 week away from the Radiothon, which is very exciting for us as science people because, of course, it is Make Contact this year, and you won't get a more juicy response from scientists than putting a science fiction theme over Radiothon this year. I'm Dr. Shane. I'm joined in the studio by the lovely Dr. Annie. Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Shane, and good morning, crew. It's so great to be back.
It is. Yeah, you had a few weeks off.
I did.
Dr. Crystal.
Good morning.
Who is, we shared a moment this week. We'll talk about that later. It was special.
Are we going to tell everyone?
Oh, I thought we should. Anyway. Chris KP.
Good morning. How are you? I can't wait to have that news shared.
Oh, well, you know. It's something that happened, but let's start with some news. Thanks for the segue. I missed it, but, you know, anyway. Dr. Crystal, what has floated your boat this week?
Well, there's been an interesting statistic going around in the news this week to do with the sequencing of the sponge genome. And
sorry, I just got excited.
It's a sea sponge found on the Great Barrier Reef, the Ansermedon queenslandii. Genome was published this week in the fifth edition of Nature and involves a team of scientists from all over the world, but includes those from the University of Queensland, led by Professor Bernard Begnan. And they found that when they sequenced the genome of this sponge, that it shared 70% of its genes with people, with humans.
Oh, 70%?
70% of sponge genes are found in people. And these students are like, oh, so we're 70% like sponges. And this is kind of a fact that's been floating around. I think they talked about it on the Breakfasters this week. But no one's really talked about, well, why do sponges have 70% of the same genes as we do? And the answer lies in the fact that sponges are actually the earliest example of a multicellular animal. Mm. Sponges kind of came to be about 625 million years ago. So this is like in the pre-Cambrian period. It doesn't get more ancient than this.
Mm.
So they're ancient animals. At about the time when cells were starting to think, hey, if we all kind of came together and you did this and I did that, then we could all kind of live in a happy little environment.
Makes sense. So the cells or the molecules then that do intracellular communication or bind cells together, which must be the same in most multicellular organisms,
are present in the sponge.
Yes, makes sense.
Because, you know, I mean, obviously sponges are quite simple animals. They don't have brains, but they do have different types of cells. I mean, there's probably only less than 10 different types of cell in a sponge, but, you know, they need cells to be the outside and the inside, mm-hmm. cells to transport nutrients around, cells with little flagella to kind of flux the water in and out of the sponges. And so they need to make decisions at a cellular level about who's going to do what. So the cells need to communicate, they need to stick together, they need to defend themselves. They need to recognise which cells are theirs and which cells are foreigners, so they've got kind of a really innate basic immune system. So a lot of the pathways that we need, it kind of shows us the genes you need to make an animal.
Mm.
And it's kind of, and they're still alive today.
So the genes you need to take molecules into cells and to eat, genes you need to make energy from cells, all those really, really, really basic things.
And also shows you that when you hear that something is 100% the same as something else, it's possibly not what you're looking at. It's a lot more interesting and a lot more basic than that.
Yeah, right? at a cellular level, mm. we're all just kind of a bit spongy on the inside.
Very interesting. Sadly, doesn't shed any light on the saying kids are sponges, but nevertheless. 70% sponges?
70% true.
70% true. Chris KP, what have you got for us?
I've got an interesting thing it's one of those things that didn't really surprise me, but it sparked a memory in my mind. Many years ago, I was at a conference thing, and I had one of those moderator people there to make it all make sense. And it was kind of an ice-breaking game, I think. He asked everybody to go out and form groups. He wanted four groups based on what they thought was most important in a personal relationship or a lover's relationship. And then the options were respect, trust, passion, and there was something else, I forget what it was. And so everyone went out and they found their group. And I was young and impetuous, so I joined the passion group. And it was actually the smallest group there, but they were all the sexiest people. And as he was going, he went through each group and sort of was asking, so why do you think this thing's important or whatever? And he got to the passion group and he said, and now look at that. They're all wearing red. And every single person in that group had some significant garment of red on, and they were all gorgeous. the reason I was reminded of it was because...
just looking around the studio at the moment. Sorry, the gals have got red on.
Yeah, I have no red on today.
Although I'm a subdued red.
You're nothing if not subtle.
I'm wearing charcoal and Chris KP is wearing what I would call mold green.
Yeah, I've got mold green and I'm not even wearing red undies today. I used to have like...
Hang
on, we'll just check the stuff right.
What are we doing? I am wearing red undies.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Speckled.
I am wearing red undies, and I know this because every morning my son and I have to coordinate our undies. His OB and not mine, but red girl this morning was red undies, Daddy. Well, red undies.
It's not as long as you've already got a pair, otherwise
well,
it
can be problematic.
And the idea of women being attractive in red, and in company here as an example, is not new. It's been over ages. It's seen as being a sexy sign, it's seen as sexually evocative, etc. What the guys at the University of Rochester have worked out, having studied hundreds of people actually, is that works for men too. Men in red, or even men framed by a red background. I'm looking out the wall in the studio.
Behind
Dr. Shane. Hey. It's more of a shade of burgundy, but we'd still class it as red.
Well, but Dr. Shane is a deep sexy.
Speaking from experience,
distraction.
Calm down.
Yes, that will make a difference. And they sort of basically got two average average face guys, stuck them in a place, and they kept it as controlled as they could, and basically, women found it significantly more sexy if the man had even a red background behind him or was wearing a red.
Well, I've heard that if you're a man and you go visit your girlfriend's parents, you shouldn't wear a red tie.
Yeah.
It would be less acceptable.
Yeah, you look like it's showing your hand, so to speak. I'm here to
red
daughter. Yes, exactly. So wear red if you can, but not at your parents' house.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. Well, I think it's confession time.
Okay. What have you two been up to?
I did something this week that I haven't done in 10 years of marriage. I went and saw a movie with another woman.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it was Dr. Crystal.
I know, I got an email during the week saying, hey, do you want to come and see a film with me?
It wasn't in that voice.
What did you go
see?
It was in Times New Roman. We actually were lucky enough to be invited by the museum to go to the new IMAX film, which is starting on the 12th of August, called Hubble 3D, which was a 3D astronomy film, essentially, about the Hubble Space Telescope, all the launch of it, the repairs that have been done to it. Basically, as we've said many times on the show, this thing's over 20 years old now, and it's sent back some of the most amazing pieces of data. And, look, I don't know, Dr. Crystal, I mean, for me, there were highlights and there were lowlights to the film. A highlight was it was free. So for a lot of people, a lowlight would be that it's quite expensive, I think, for a 45-minute film.
Oh, yeah, because it's club.
Yeah, it's IMAX. And it's $17.50 for adults and $12.50 for children, which I have to say for a 45-minute film is pretty pricey, so they may need to look at that. But the visuals were spectacular. I mean, the footage of the Hubble and the astronauts repairing it, which they've obviously spent a lot of time taking this footage. Special trained crews went up to take this IMAX footage, and that was wild. The Leonardo DiCaprio overkill voiceover kind of ruined it a little bit for me, but, you know, you seem to enjoy that type of thing.
I actually really enjoyed it, because it was a 3D film, and it was designed to be a 3D film. You really were flying through space. Like, they were showing all of the Hubble images, and really you're flying through the stars, and it's like you're journeying back in time, because the light from these stars has taken billions of years to get to Hubble. So you're not just flying through space, you're time-travelling in a cinema, and I was fantastic.
Yeah. See, you were actually, I mean, I sit up 3 a.m. and watch the shuttle launches and so forth, you know I do that, but this was quite different. You were sitting on the gantry as the shuttle launched, and that in 3D with the sound and that was just unreal. And my wife, when I told her about it, she said, you know, could we take our son, because he loves this sort of stuff. And I said, look, the bottom line is the experience was just too much for the little kid. It was too loud, and it was too real, and I think he'd actually freak out, because it was just, that part was phenomenal. And just watching the astronauts, I mean, you've got to picture this, right? You're sitting on the shuttle, and poking out from where you're sitting is the Hubble Space Telescope, right? And there's a couple of guys there repairing it, and behind the actual telescope is the Earth Vista. And, I mean, that was just, in 3D, that was just wild.
Yeah,
so
it would have been, yeah.
It was well worthwhile. I think, you know, as I say, there was a couple of minor things, and I think the price for be a bit problematic for some people. But, you know, if you can get there, there is a family ticket of $50, which makes it a bit better. But it's well worth seeing.
Sounds like a great trip.
It was a great trip. And some of the, like the stars shooting by you as Crystal said, you head out was just, it was wild.
It was pretty magnificent.
Go where no imagination
is. And I think I'm probably not going to get up into space, so it was a...
Well, not with that attitude, no.
No. I still have hope that they'll need to do an appropriate experiment on an appropriately old person.
Yeah, that's what I want. Yeah, I want to be the first granny in space. I mean, you know, the times are fleeting. And
that's right.
All passing them by, but I'm ready to be experimented on.
So anyway, it starts on the 12th of August. So people should get along to the IMAX at the Melbourne Museum because it is it's well worth having a look at this because Hubble is something that won't be around for that much longer and I think this will probably go as well. So, have a look.
And plus the mint chop tops are good.
Oh, we didn't partake.
Do you? Oh, it was a bit early in the morning.
I'm normally a vanilla chop top person, but when I go to IMAX,
I didn't want any distractions.
What kind of a date was this?
Well, we focused on the romance. There wasn't enough time for food. Yeah.
Talking about museums, I heard someone come up to me the other day and said, oh, I heard some people in the breakfast who were balking about Contrasaurus. I thought, why were they balking about it? I didn't hear it, but I then thought, oh, probably because it's a big multinational sponsoring a dinosaur. Now, I thought what I'd do is a bit of investigative journalism. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I guess the concern about multinationals creeping into government spaces is that that's what they're doing. But in actual fact, this is a wonderful story.
It's a great story.
And can I say at the outset, more company, social responsibility, give your money to worthwhile things. Now, Qantas are not going to sell any more airline tickets by sponsoring a dinosaur, but they are going to be good corporate social responsible citizens, and that's exactly what they were. The Quadrosaurus is this animatronic display at the museum, and it's really quite good, actually. It's very young. It's the best animatronic I've ever seen. And what happened was, about 11 years ago, they contributed some money to the research of digging up dinosaurs and things, and a lot of companies do. In fact, I looked at other companies too, and what the scientists do, scientists have naming rights for anything, and it has to go through a particular zoological nomenclature sort of rule book, and the naming has to go through a society and a name, so nothing gets pressed upon scientists to name it. Now, because of the generous corporate social responsibility that was given to Pat and Tom Rich of Museum Victoria at the time, acknowledged the help of Qantas in this research, they named the dinosaur Quantasaurus, and so they should. I reckon, if we look back in history, most of our body parts are named by curious, wealthy, status-seeking, dead white men.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of our physics, too, our ants, our vaults, our galvanised,
our Higgs boson,
our broken areas in the brain, our Henle's
tubes,
you got it. These are all named after dead white wealthy men that were curious
and the
about
quite,
the world.
The Richards have got quite a number of species named after them already too.
Well, look, he named a dinosaur after his daughter Leonosaurus.
Yeah,
he also named a dinosaur after one of the earth moving companies that were just beyond the call of their corporate social responsibility, Atlas Copernosaurus, which he did out of the goodness of his heart, and also, because, a lot of species are found and they need names. And remember a while ago, I think about a year ago, Dr. Shane, was it, we had someone who was selling the name on eBay?
Yes.
And I also talked to a scientist up in the marine lab, Jo Tyler, bless her soul. She's a wonderful, wonderful marine scientist. And she named a shrimp after her husband after 15 years of marriage. So as a 15th anniversary, she named it. Now,
I thought maybe that meant something else.
No. She was conscious about that, actually.
With cold water, come on.
She said she wanted to pick the right shrimp to represent her husband. And what happened was, I remember there was a wonderful story I found at the museum that Tom Rich said to somebody during a dig. They were looking to, if anyone finds a monotrine or some sort of ancient marsupial in this dig, I will give them a cubic metre of chocolate.
Because
he actually was...
It's a lot.
I know,
right.
And guess what? Someone found one. And so they named him... I can't pronounce it, but the last part of the Latin name was Cadbrii. Because obviously Cadbrii helped put forward something. But what I reckon, and I want to see more Qantasauruses, I want to see more multinationals support small pockets of researching. It's not as though, you know, I mean, yes, they creep into spaces, but they are the wealthy and the powerful of today, just like the wealthy and the powerful of yesteryear were the dead, wealthy, curious white males who said, oh, I'm going to name this after myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say corporate social responsibility, bring it on, bring some more. Qantasauruses are so cute, little fern-eating dogs.
They do. I do have one concern, though, Dr. Andy, I'll finish on that, is that particular animal now will be pronounced in a certain way by those who are from Japan in a very disturbing way. And I'm not going to say it on air because it's a children's program, but they have trouble saying Qantas. And if you work out the way they say it, that Qantasaurus may be disturbing to some small children. So anyway, hello to all our listeners in Japan, but I'll tell you once I turn the microphones off, Dr. Andy. Here's a little thing just to put the flavour on people from the museum. I love people from museums. Go.
3, 2, 1.
We're joined now by Dr. Michael Lynch, who's a veterinarian at the Melbourne Zoo. Welcome to the Einstein Go Go Studio.
Good morning. Good to be here.
I think this is the first time we've had a vet from the zoo in a long time.
In a very long time.
In a very long time.
Yeah, because I remember years ago, we went to the zoo once with Robin Girl, wanted to interview a seal. We interviewed one of the vet people there too. But, it looks like our zoos are our fellow zoologists who are out there practicing in the world of animals. Yeah. So they're the one here.
Yeah, they're doing some cool things. Yeah. Now, Michael, you've been working in particular on the Australian fur seal. Tell us a bit about this little guy. Well, he's not that little, I suppose. They're quite big. But my understanding is that the numbers from the sealing days, you know, which is over 100 years ago now, still haven't recovered.
Yeah, well, the thought is that pre-sealing there was maybe 250,000 Australian fur seals, the total population, and that is only based on when they started sealing, the numbers of skins that were going out in ports. That's at a maybe estimate of the population. In the last 20 years or so, the population has increased from about 70,000 up to about 120,000. So you can see it's still not back to the pre-sealing level. And it's an interesting animal because relative to other fur seal populations, quite a small population, also a very restricted range. And the recovery of the population is thought in part to be slow because of the food resource. They mainly or almost entirely forage on the floor of the continental in Bass Strait, and not a very nutrient-rich environment, and so that has flow-on effects to slow recovery. That's the sort of traditional thinking.
So given that it has such a restricted range in terms of where we find these guys, does that mean it's particularly susceptible to, you know, extinction events like climatic change and so forth?
Yeah, well, that's why I was one of the reasons I chose this species to look at their health, because in other populations, other seal populations in the northern hemisphere, there's been mass mortality events where, you know, say up to tens of thousands of seals have died from viral infections and things like that. So if you introduce a new pathogen into a naive population that has a restricted range, that can spread very easily between animals and go right across the range of that animal. You don't have a insurance population over the other side of the country or elsewhere. So
this is what's currently happening with the Tasmanian devil. I got that wrong last week.
Yeah, I love the tiger.
It has problems too, I understand. It's still wandering around. But that's the same scenario, isn't it, where there's no sort of backup.
That's right. And that's why I suppose going back to the role of zoos in that, of course, you need a lot of investigations, a lot of health investigations going into that in situ. But zoos have got some insurance populations going because you want to take some animals out of there so you've got them in case you actually can't work out how to control that disease.
So this is one role of the zoo, is to take those, you know, like the elephants and some of the other elements, take them out of the wild and keep the populations going. But there's a different role here you're talking about where you're actually going out of the zoo and looking at the populations that we have and presumably helping them in some way.
Yeah, I suppose traditionally studying the ecology of wildlife populations, disease is run a second to those other factors like competition for resources, breeding sites and things like that in terms of understanding the population dynamics. And so because of these events in the northern hemisphere of seals, mass mortalities and things like that, we didn't know hardly anything about our local species, about their health status. And so important to understand what diseases are there and what influence they might be having on the population dynamics. So this project's concerned with going out and trying to do some disease surveillance and then trying in the longer term to work out what effects they're having.
I noticed one of the diseases that was mentioned in your brief was alopecia, that the first eels are losing their fur. What's going on there?
Good question. Well, I suppose the project has two parts. One is the disease surveillance part, where you're looking for diseases that have been seen elsewhere, and the other is a more reactive reactive part. There are two health issues, if you like, that I'm investigating. One is an abortion issue, and the other is alopecia issue. So in about 1989, the first cases of this particular pattern of bilaterally symmetrical hair loss were seen on these seals. So mm-hmm. It means it's not patchual over their body. It's a very distinct pattern
right. On
the thorax and the head, and in severe cases over the entire back. And that the odd case we've seen for many years, but over the last sort of five to eight years, in one particular location, Lady Julia Percy Island, which is southwestern Victoria, there is apparently an increased prevalence of this condition. So for the past 3 years, I've gone out there and basically estimated the prevalence of the condition, described the condition, who's been who gets it and who doesn't.
Is it a pathogen? Is it like a virus or a pathogen?
Genetic kind of breeding?
Well, these are all the good questions. I set up what they call a case control study, where I've caught affected animals and not affected animals and looked for those sorts of issues. So what I can tell you is that all the common things like a folliculitis that might cause your hair to drop out and things are not happening with these animals, or a parasitic infection and things like that. So
Still an unknown.
So my approach is to be looking at what's different about this site, looking at nutritional factors, looking at toxic factors, but also going back to the mechanism of how they're losing their hair. So I'm looking at thyroid hormone fluctuations, mm-hmm. because first eels, they need that fur. They molt once a year, and looking at the changes maybe in the molt and what might be affecting that. For instance, in other seal species, molt is regulated by thyroid hormones. Thyroid hormones can be affected by toxins in the environment. And so you go out and feed. Is there something about that area?
Yeah,
and so I've got fat biopsies, things like that, hair samples.
Oh,
and looking.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, for example, the entire population of seals that are off best rate and so forth were eliminated. Does the sort of range of zoos across Australia have enough to maintain the population, or genetically just not a diverse enough population to continue it?
Oh, yeah, well, no. Keeping marine mammals in captivity is a highly intensive thing to do, so short answer, no. But that's not the object of this study. There's no immediate danger of these seals becoming mm-hmm. extinct in the wild, as it is, say, for the Tasmanian devil mm-hmm. and or the Asian elephant. So this is a different sort of thing, where you're looking at the management and conservation of species by understanding more about the factors that influence it. So no, the zoo doesn't have a role there in preserving them through preservation of genetic material. That comes at the crisis point. Mm. That's where zoos have their role on that thing.
When you examine a seal, like, what do? You look in its mouth, and do you poke anything up its anywhere? And I just wondering what the best does with a seal.
A research vet or a clinical vet in the
world? How do you take its blood pressure? Like, I'm thinking about my visit to the doctor and thinking about the seal's visit to
you. You're not a seal.
I know, but you're like, what would you do if I was a seal? Sorry, this is a really dumb question.
That's okay. If you're trying to assess the health of an animal, I'm actually sort of surveying for antibodies to particular diseases. I'm measuring body condition and length in these seals, weighing them, things like that. So I develop a body condition index. I look for antibodies to specific diseases.
So you take blood from them?
I do take blood
from them. Do they mind you sticking a needle in them? Are they friendly? Do they come up to you and go, my turn to get weighed?
Different seal species have different response to humans. The Australian fur seals are scared of us. They'll just flee. And so we've got to be very careful working around the population so we don't scare the whole lot into the water or damage them.
Yeah.
So we creep around on our valleys and catch them in animals on the outskirts of the population in nets. And if I'm just taking the blood, we can just leave the animal while it's restrained in the net.
Right.
Very, very short procedure. But if I'm investigating the alopecia issue, we actually anaesthetise the seal,
intubate it,
and then we monitor end tidal CO2, all these sorts of things.
Intubate it means put something against
the brain. That's right, yes.
Okay.
Deliver the anaesthetic gas.
And do you talk seal?
Do I talk seal?
Yes, can you talk seal?
Well,
Oh, right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want to impersonate the whole accent,
I want to try and talk to you with you.
Is it like an old seal or a young seal?
Oh,
very personal. There, right?
I suppose the interesting thing when you're on a seal colony is that the mothers will come back, and so there's all these masses of pups sitting around, and the mothers come back and they give a call, like a. There you go. And the pup will answer, which is a higher pitch thing. So that's the pup. But what happens is, because it's a tough life when you're a seal, so when that mother comes, you'll see this animal come out of the sea, an adult female, she'll give that call, and about 20 pups will answer. And it's all because it's a tough life out there if you're a top-level predator.
Got it.
And, they all want to feed.
Tough life in the feed. Now, just before we go, Michael, I just wanted to ask you, how's the new elephant going there at Melbourne Zoo? Because you mentioned the Asian elephants, and there's been a very big success over the last sort of year with the birth of the new elephant there. And every time
Is in Sydney. This is
Marley.
What's your problem? But every time I've been there, the queues have been too long, and we've ended up hibernating in the butterfly enclosure. But has the health of the animal going there? Is it going
well? Oh, fantastic! Yeah, now's the time to go because those initial queues have died down. But young animals are playful animals. As you get older, you get a bit more serious, just like in humans. And so having a young animal like that, pardon you guys, having a young animal like that just running around the enclosure, her interactions with the other elephants, it just makes it so much more dynamic. It's just a wonderful animal to watch. And we're really enjoying it being there, and we're expecting another arrival in September.
A
little sister or brother.
Yeah. What does a fully grown Asian elephant weigh?
Females weigh about 3,000 to about 3,300. And
kilos.
And a male will weigh about, 4,500 kilos. Yeah.
Right. That is truly amazing.
And do you ever find them in the fridge hiding in the butter?
No, I think not. Michael is...
good elephant joke.
We can, if you've got some of that, work on the city. We could use it. Dr. Michael Lynch from the Melbourne Zoo, a veterinarian there working on the Australian first seal population, amongst other things. Thank you very much for coming in today. We wish you the best of luck, and no doubt we'll be getting many more great guests from the zoo on over the coming months. It's certainly giving us a unique and different insight into the activities of the zoo, which I think a lot of people are often not aware of, just how much you guys do out there in the wilderness, so to speak. And we'll take care of Dr. Andy during the break, no doubt. Here on 3RRR, we have got Dr. Andy back in her cage. She is under control, more or less.
Thank you for the injection. That was so nice.
Yep, that's really that peanut butter injection really worked. Chris KP.
Hi, mate.
What have you got for us?
Let's continue our animal theme, if that's okay. But at the absolute, pretty much, other end of the spectrum, I'm wondering about ants, because ants rock. And it's one of those things that you just sort of, if you know anything about ecology or ants at all, you immediately think, okay, they're kind of clever and nifty. But they are, they are an animal that keeps giving. And when friends and I were discussing this, we're sort of looking into what ants do, and you see it in your own backyard, in terms of having this incredibly complex communication system, which is based partly on movement and dance, which I appreciate, partly based on pheromones. They have an incredibly complex and yet very well-structured social structure, so there is the queen, there are the workers, etc., and not all species are the same, but they do know their role. Any organisation that works well is because the individuals know their role and they play it out to the nth degree.
They're team players.
And I was going to say, sporting teams are exactly the same. You watch any good sporting team sport, is because everyone knows they're fit and they get it done perfectly.
They're a champion team instead of a team of champions.
That's exactly right. That's probably up on the hive wall somewhere, on the net. There's no I in ant.
But there is me in team.
It'll be ant.
Yes, but there is a me in team.
Well, that's true, yeah. But no one's talking about you. That's true, actually. But
and there's man and manners.
Yeah, you're right. And there's tea in team too.
All right, and you were saying
Sorry, distracted. Anyway, so yeah, that's all great. It's fantastic. By the way, it's known as eusociality, that the very highest level of social structure, and that's what ants exhibit, and they are the best at it. Anyway, so we started looking into individual ants, and we stumbled upon a species called Camponotus saunderi. Saundersi. I don't know who Saunders is, presumably someone who is like an ant. But the reason these guys are important, and they're found in Malaysia and a few other places in that neck of the woods, is that the workers on the outside of the nest, they will do the absolute ultimate when push comes to shove. So their job is to find food sources, bring it back. Their job is also to protect the nest, so if someone's threatening it, hey, you've got to explain, it's security, basically, they're bouncers. But they've evolved an incredibly cool, self-sacrificial way of doing this, if it gets nasty. Basically, now pretty much the entire side of the ant are what are effectively poison glands. They're pumped full of acetophenone, among other things. And if they can't do anything else, if waving my legs at you and nipping at you with my mandibles doesn't work, if running at you doesn't work and you're still threatening the nest, what they will do is they tuck their abdomen right up against themselves, they rupture the gland under their mandibles, basically blow their head off and spray acetophenone complexes all over the invader.
Suicide bombing here.
It's suicide bombing. Now, I'm yet to find a video of this. So if there are entomologists out there listening who have got a video of Camponotus saundersi doing this, I will pay you for it. It's not much. Perhaps just a coffee. But something, and I would love you forever. But it's an awesome idea. So I just love the idea that at one end of the spectrum, you've got this incredibly complex system working together, doing a lot of bits. And they've been around for like 20 million years getting it right. They've survived climate changes, they survived humans coming in and knocking things down, they survived chemical warfare, they just keep going. And again, it's because they've got an incredibly complex good structure which comes down at some point to an individual who, in this case, is prepared to actually blow their own head off, pretty much, to save the nest. With that in mind, we were inspired musically, and there is no way to express this musically without making it grunty. And this is what we come up with.
Walking is a lot like life. It's dangerous and not much fun if you don't know how to do it. And just like life, if you hesitate or drag your feet, you'll certainly get cut.
Triple R. You are on 3RRR. It's Einstein Go-Go, and we have about 15 or 16 minutes to go before we have to hand over to Cam, the chef de cuisine. Yeah, that's the of humour.
Cuisine.
Yeah, I know, that just didn't work. But
love cuisine.
Well, he's chef of something. I mean, he is chef of something, actually.
He's
if you
a man
talk.
Of food maker.
But he said some interesting things about us last week, about us sucking the intellect out of the airways, I think, or something to that effect. And in response, I said, we love you, Cam. Looking forward to your show. Now, Dr. Andy... well, or I could go with the Harrison Ford version from... Remember the film? The old film where he goes and he builds the ice machine and he has this way of saying, have a nice day. And it means it in a certain loving way. Anyway, Dr. Andy, I actually grabbed a little piece for you as your intro. I'm going to leave your mic on, so don't say anything embarrassing. Here we go.
Never send a monster to do the work of an evil scientist. Now be a cooperative little body and let me have your brain.
Sorry, Doc, but I need what little I got.
On that note, over to you, Dr. Andy.
That'd be great, Greg. That's a wonderful Mel Blanc from Bugs Bunny cartoons, isn't it?
Yeah, I saw that.
Good stuff. Now, listen, I was going to do this for news, but I actually felt it requires a little bit more reflection and discussion. And that's why I've chosen to do this as a story today. What's happening is, if we look back at the history of antidepressants, it's rather interesting. You could actually map the way we manage depression by looking at the various pharmacological agents that have made an effect on the brain. And, of course, the first lot of monoamine oxidase inhibitors, the MAOs, and then they were the first lots that were prescribed to depression. Then, of course, there were the tricyclic antidepressants that came on the market. So these were finally a recourse for depressive patients that was drug-oriented. Before that, we really had no drugs for depression. It was
About when did this start?
Mayo's, when did that? Was that 50s?
No, maybe. I mean, because electroconvulsive shock was...
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't know the exact date of that. I didn't write that down. But, of course, in the 1990s, we had a big paradigm shift in the types of drugs that we used for depression, which is the Prozacs of the world. That was a sort of a major shift in the types of drugs that we used for depression. They were no longer the tricyclics or monoamine oxidase inhibitors. These were now the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, often referred to as SSRIs. Now, these made a huge difference as to how depression was handled. They seemed to be more effective. They didn't have the side effects of many of the tricyclics, which were things like dry mouth and all sorts of not quite nice side effects that people had to deal with. Now, this was a major shift in the type of drug that was prescribed. Now, these also had diversified into not just selective serotonin uptake inhibitors, but to also ones that included noradrenaline. So there were the SNRIs. So these were also working on two different types of neurotransmitters, serotonin and noradrenaline. So these diversified, but essentially the same class of drugs.
In being reuptake inhibitors, they actually, how do they work?
Well, okay, the assumption is that there were low serotonin levels. So if you inhibit...
Which are causing depression.
Yes. So that was what the theory was. Now, I'm saying was, because I think we might be on the cusp of another change of drug therapy, which is amazing, but I'm not sure. But I thought I'd talk about it here and I'm starting to go,
serotonin is one of those things that, this is a vicious cycle as I understand it, because you produce serotonin when you sleep, but when you get depressed, it's partly because of, or maybe because of your serotonin levels, but then if you are really depressed, you tend not to sleep, and so in at least one category, some people are getting to the point where they're not sleeping, they're producing, you know, very low amounts of serotonin as a result, and it cascades and it gets out of hand. And that's where some of these drugs in the past have assisted that category of people.
In fact, I can remember being in my doctor saying, oh, you're suffering a sleep cycle disorder, meaning that sleep was not quality sleep. I was an insomniac and I was worried about something. This is decades ago. And in fact, often these presented itself as that sleep cycle disorder. Myself was...
yeah. I think most people probably have some sleep.
In fact, I don't think I know anyone that hasn't had a sleep cycle disorder for a short time. It's when it's long term that it becomes quite disruptive to work and play. Now, so as you asked, Dr. Cruz, it is about because of the assumption of low serotonin. Now, I've just said we're on the cusp of something new, because the new theory in thinking came from this lot of research. They looked at serotonin levels, and they said, hang on, while serotonin might be low in some areas, it's actually high in others. How can that be? There must be more to this story. Now, this story, to cut a long story short, led to them looking for different types of serotonin neurons, or serotonin subgroups of serotonin neurons. And that's in fact what seems to be presenting itself. Now let's go back and have a look at where the research came from. They were surprised to see this in some depressive patients, and some of the research actually came out of Melbourne, here from the Baker Institute, Murray Esler, the Baker Heart Research Institute in Melbourne. He found that levels of serotonin in brains of people with panic disorder was 4 times higher than in healthy volunteers. And in depressed people who were not receiving treatment, it was 2 times higher than in the volunteers.
So they actually had higher levels of serotonin.
Yes. And that's kind of, that actually set a rethinking about, hang on, what's going on here?
Well, now, you have to ask the question at that point.
Yeah.
Is the problem being experienced by these particular patients due to increased serotonin rather than a decrease? And so if you give them that same medication, presumably you're making them worse.
Possibly. And this goes into this contentious area which I was debating about how to talk about, which was that some depressive patients showed an impulsivity towards suicide, and it's possible that those levels increase to that brain impulsivity.
What does that mean? Does that mean more likely to?
More likely to, yes. So that's an awkward area, but it actually meant that these people, instead of being, you can imagine that these drugs, if they make you a bit more impulsive, might make you a bit more spontaneous and happy as well, because you see things that you may not have in a depressed state. So, you see how it's like two halves of the same coin? Now, I'm adding a little bit of sort of, I guess, a reflection on that. But if you do want to chase up this article, this is in the July 24th issue of New Scientist. The more I read this article, and I read it a couple of times, I actually thought, gosh, does this mean we have to rethink what causes depression and therefore rethink the drug elements of it?
I think it's really interesting, because I guess we're treating depression as one umbrella term,
yes.
And it would be as if we were treating cancer as one umbrella term, because the thing about cancer is that cancer isn't just one disease. Cancer is many different types of diseases, and there are different drugs which are effective at different types of cancer.
Yes.
And I guess we're really under-informed about mental health, and the fact that depression perhaps isn't one enormous, it's an umbrella term for many different types of diseases which have many different types of mechanisms and so need different types of treatment.
That's absolutely true. And what this revealing evidence showed, that even though there are two types of serotonin receptors, guess what? There's also a different time response for these receptors.
Mm.
So we're now adding a level of complexity in what you've just described, and they will be individual levels of complexity as well, as even with the same cancer, you can have different responses to that cancer because of your underlying immunopharmacology.
Mm.
So,
I think what it really highlights is our lack of knowledge into the mechanisms that underlie depression at a sort of biochemical and neuronal level. I think that there's a real need for increased funding and research in this area. So it's fantastic to hear that this research is being done.
I can imagine that would be very hard, where these experiments are obviously done in rats, where you segment up the rat and
talk up
yeah.
one of the researchers.
But how would you determine in a given patient?
Exactly.
You know, sorry to steal the thunder of a question, but how would you go about determining what parts of the person's brain have more or less serotonin than is I guess appropriate or best for them?
Yeah.
And then determine that without sectioning up their brain a la rat.
Well, I guess this is why you need to do those experiments on rats, because you might find that a certain level of serotonin in the brain corresponds to a certain level of serotonin in the blood, or there might be other markers that you could find which would be in the blood, and so you could you can use this type of research to really try and develop your biomarkers, as they're called, for these diseases. And I think that's where experiments in animals can really inform diagnostics in humans.
Mm.
That's precisely right, and I think those biomarkers are the diagnostic key to this next phase of depression medication, which, I mean, in some ways they're still SSRIs, but the more and more I read this, it was no longer just about serotonin. It was about serotonin types of neurons and serotonin timing. Now, let me tell you about the time experiment. This is what this group did. They were from the University of South Dakota, and they injected some stress-related molecules into the brains of rats. And they found that it triggered two phase responses in the rats. The initial wave of serotonin appeared to increase the fear-like behaviour of rats, while the second decreased this behaviour because it activated the brain regions in the sort of prefrontal cortex, which is often more planning and
judgment,
which is associated with the calming of fears. So the fact that this actually occurred also suggests there's more biomarkers, exactly what you said, that need to be looked at. I thought this was pretty amazing stuff, and I think that SSRIs were really quite an important part of our drug pharmacological history of dealing with depression. And of course, what's interesting too is Yes, the Mayo were the 1950s. Thank you for that. Of course they were. I think it's not too bad. We've got a point about the previous
passing notes across
thank
the
you.
Studio.
The other side.
Yeah. But you know what I think is interesting too is that the various types of therapies that are important to various depression conditions are, of course, this increase in social isolation people have. Really interesting that more we have social isolation, even though we have more increased communications technology, we're not really having real experiences of making sense of the world, which is why talk therapies work. What's also interesting is we're reducing activity. What isn't interesting that exercise works for depression. So whilst I'm not advocating that drugs are the new silver bullet, because they never have been and probably may not evolve to be the absolute panacea, but alongside the social therapies, alongside the exercise therapies, alongside all the various forms that keep us functioning in the world and making sense of the world so it doesn't overwhelm us and stop us from working and playing, then I'm excited that this new phase of drug development can go ahead.
That's definitely interesting stuff, and I think it's fair to say that in terms of personalised medicine, we are just scratching the surface in so many areas. I mean, there's some areas where, I guess cancer is an example, where it's starting to really, be more about individual
personalized
patients.
Treatment.
Yeah, but in so many areas, and this particular area of healthcare is one where personalised treatments are not quite what they need to be, and sadly, Australia is not really up there in terms of this. We need to move forward on this. Now, Chris KP, speaking of moving forward, let's move forward to, that's four times this show.
Are you
looking for an election campaign?
No, I'm mocking an election campaign.
it's such a fine line, though, that,
But speaking of campaigns that you want people to vote for, it is Science Week coming up. Tell us what's going on.
Yes, it is. Very soon coming up. Okay, so Science Week is officially, for those of you who, care about specific dates, it's from the 14th to the following Sunday, whatever that is.
21st?
That'll work. Let's go to the 21st.
You add 7?
Eight, I think, because it's Saturday to Sunday.
Oh, 22nd.
Yeah. Right.
National Science Week.
It's not an Earth Week.
I saw a pamphlet that said National Science Month somewhere.
Did you?
Yeah.
Might have been a typo. Oh. Although they do have one, apparently, I think in China now, seriously, they have a National Science Week month, week, and day. And you have to be involved.
Oh, really?
Is there a theme for this year's National Science Week?
Well, here's a note. Science Week has a theme which is primarily for schools to use because it gives them some focus their work and that's important for a school, and that is this year is Australian Biodiversity, which is a reflection of the International Year of Biodiversity.
Yeah.
That said, I mean, Science Week has never put restrictions on two things. One is, three things in fact, never put restrictions on who's involved, never put restrictions on what you want to do, and never put restrictions on even when it is, frankly. If it's in August, we'll take it, that's fine. So there is a very broad-minded view, because let's face it, if you've got an awesome idea for an event, and it's going to be 2 days outside of the week official, it'd be nuts to go, sorry, you don't get to be involved in this. Yeah, so it's very broad-minded. And there is a reflection of that in the events that are on. Look, there is, if you're out and about, there is a nice little paper brochure. It's not everything, but it's got some nice stuff in it in terms of a taster for what's on. I'd recommend two places to go and look at. One is the official Science Week website, which is scienceweek.gov.au. I'd also recommend rescience.org.au, which is re-science, I think. Yes, it is. Because that's a slightly more crystallised version, and it's a nice tasty, yeah.
So apart from schools becoming involved in National Science Week, how can just the general public...
Okay, those two websites are worth going to. That's a very good place to look, because most stuff in Science Week is not for schools. This is the bottom line. Most of it is elsewhere.
And so ReScience and scienceweek.gov are places to go to see what's out there for you. And I would do that because it's too much. You've got to pick out the bits you care about and the bits you can get to. One thing I will focus on briefly, though, is that so the week starts officially on the 14th. There are events all over the joint. One that's coming up, which is specifically not for schools, and I would encourage people in Melbourne to get to, is called Market of the Mind. It taps back into to Andy's story to some extent, in that it's going to be loaded with neurology, brain-inspired artworks, performance art pieces, rock music. There may even be some medical instrumentation / performance going on. And that's on at the QB Square, so it's in the middle of the city. It's free. It's on the 13th. It's Friday the 13th. I'm hoping we'll be able to tap into some science and superstition too, because it's Friday the 13th. Either that or we'll get by vampires on the way there. So yeah, 5:30 till 9 PM, rock up, it's free, and there will be an awesome brain-inspired bar. I'm told that there will be $5 brain hemorrhages at the bar, which is an awesome cocktail, and will make your brain do odd things. Anyway, so that's on, but you go to the website or grab a brochure, which is out now in places, hotels, pubs, cafes, etc. That's a very good place to find.
Very, very good. Well, and those of you who've been listening, the tracks we've played today are Like Love by Melanie Horsmill, Architecture in Helsinki by Hearted Races, and the one that Chris put in, of course, Anti-Establishmentism by the Great Big Science Geek. Sorry about that, folks. You've been listening to Einstein and Gogo, and we are, as a team, extremely excited about next week, because Radiothon is on for 2 weeks. So we are going to try somehow to combine science with subscriptions, with a bit of fun, and we'll be making contact with as many of you as possible.
So subscribe and make it so.
Make it so. It's going to be an absolute blast. We've had a great day today with the team. Dr. Andy, thanks again.
Good to see you.
See you soon. Dr. Crystal.
Always a pleasure.
And Chris KP.
It was a blast, dude. Thanks.
Yeah, well, I'm Dr. Shane. You've been listening to Einstein and Gogo on 3RRR. We also thank our guest from the Melbourne Zoo, Michael Lynch. We're going to leave you now.
This has been a podcast from 3RRR 102.7 FM in Melbourne. Truly independent community radio. Want to hear more? Check out our website at rrr.org.au.